for somebody that couldn't make it today. Where we left off, kind of chit-chatting about things, conformers, regulators, in case you can't see me. And, you know, the structure of the class is kind of like free will, you know, kind of like we just go with the flow. And I know that some of you have been like, oh, what's going to be an exam? I don't worry about exams. I was thinking, you know, what I do in the 446 class, this is neurophys class, I think it works out really well, but you can tell me if you don't want to do this, but I think it'll be fun. Because at this level, this is, you know, a more advanced level, we're not interested in like a med school class where you just cram content and then you vomit it all back out again. That's just horrible because it doesn't retain anything. How about we do something like this? We have a series of questions. There's 13 of you in here, but we have like 14 or 15 questions. We put that on a sheet. We have 15 questions. Give it to all of you, and you can start a Google Docs, right? Share, what do you call it? GroupMe thing, that's what I mean. GroupMe thing. And you'll answer questions as a team. And then what we do in 446, which is really great, I have a crayfish hat that says, I love crayfish. We put all your names in there. And then we mix them up. And then we have a fun day. It's not a stressful day, it's a fun day. And then we pull names out of a hat. And then you say, you get question number one, Morgan. And then, you say, oh my God, okay, I wasn't ready for one. I answered number five. But that means you have to know question number one and the answer for number one. So you work as a team to figure it out. And then you say, okay, I got most of it. Anybody want to add to it or something? It's, you know, and I'll always, because I can't resist not talking, I'll always add to it a bit. But then we hand all those questions in ahead of time, then I get to read over and say, oh, maybe we could emphasize a little bit more of that, okay? And then we go to the next question, next question, next question. So you don't know which question you're going to get, but you got to know the answers kind of to all of them. But you can use your notes too, okay? Because at this level, what do we really want to get out of education in class? Is learning the content and team working together, right? Because in real life, what do? Do you really work in isolation out there all the time? No, you have to reach out, you have to ask people. This is the way science progresses. Does that sound good? As I care, I mean, I do not care about all A's in here, right? We're not trying to make a C count, or, you know, just come, interact, learn. My view is, I love the way my prof that was in Switzerland at the time, he taught med school class at the University of Basel. He said, get rid of all the grades. We just need pass fail. You know, you come to class, you talk about it, you get out of what you want out of it, right? And that's going to be your future, what you signed up. You sign up for the class, you pay your money, we cover the content. You can go more in depth, you can go less in depth, whatever you really want to get out of it, okay? Does that sound good? Because it's more advanced class, and it's not just trying to cram information, you regurgitate everything. All right, so that's it. And then you can, you know, Lauren will answer all the questions for you. No, I'm joking with you. Sorry. She knows me well enough. Okay, does that sound good for that? So relax, don't get all stressed out, because there's so much different information here and there, and you might think, well, what are we really covering? So I think at the end of the day, we kind of say, what are the main things that we covered? You know, what should we really kind of retain from it? What's the take-home message? And what was the take-home message last time? Lots of different things, right? Because we're just covering here and there, and you might get a little like, what on earth do I have to remember, right? So I don't want you to have that freaking out moment like, oh, do I have to know exact equation of a pH, you know, something? But no, does pH change with temperature, for example? Yes. How does it change? Does it go up? Does it go down? And then you can have your open notes to answer your own questions at your own time, right? So when we get questions, we have to have some kind of exam, some kind of content to show that there was exams in the course, but it's kind of a group discussion exam aspect. We used to call it, it's a little early in the morning, maybe we'll call it donut day. In my 446 class, it was usually in the afternoon, so we called it pizza day, so we ordered pizza for everybody, and we had pizza, and we had a discussion, and then we answered questions. So maybe I just have to get donuts, or we can get something else if somebody doesn't like sugar. Okay, so we'll do something like that. But anyways, so we left off last time talking about homeostasis, a little bit about homeostasis, conformers, regulators, and we can go a little bit more into that depth too. And then I sent you the PDF and the some papers and a copy of a chapter, and then some papers that we can go over a little bit too, just to kind of get us in the same mindset of why do we want to even talk about comparative physiology and all that. So conformers, what did we kind of say that's a little bit of the problem with conformer, using that term conformers and regulators, anybody remember? And I might be a little confused with what I'm talking about in 350 Animal Phys, because that's going on the other days of this Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then I'm like, this class is advanced comparative phys, and it's like, God, what did I cover on the other day? So just say, oh, you didn't talk about that yet, or we didn't discuss that, that's completely fine, okay? Good. Did we talk about conformers and regulators a little bit? No? Yes? No? No? Okay, good.
I think you threw the word out there, but we never really kind of discussed
it. Okay. So think about, I mean, like today outside, how cold it is, right? But we didn't, our body temperature didn't drop. But if you were an insect, what would happen to you out there? You probably got pretty cold, right? Because you conform pretty much to the environment. But is it really a conformer? What do you think an insect would do out there on a cold day? There's a beetle. It kind of is conforming, but it says it's cold. What's it going to do? I'm always surprised in the spring how fast insects come back, aren't you? Mm-hmm. And I was like, when I was a kid, I was thinking, gosh, well, not really that young of a kid, but anyways, in West Texas, we had cold days that were really freezing because I grew up in West Texas. And, you know, snow and everything. And but then spring comes along and bloody mosquitoes are out already, you know? And I think, where do they come from? And, you know, you think migrating animals, right? So they went all south and somehow in 2 days they're all back again, you know? Like, did they migrate that far? What happened? So what do you think? I'm kind of getting your brain juices going.
Well, maybe some of their processes conform, but there's like, they try and regulate whether it's behavioral or internal processes to, I think the word is critical values, right? They want to stay within.
Yes.
The critical values, yeah. And so they'll die then otherwise. Yeah.
So they might hide, right? They might go into detritus in the soil. They might try to stay warm in another way. And that's supposedly what happens, right? So they get down in the ground, they get down in a warm spot, and it's much probably like mammals do too, right? They don't want to be in the cold. You want to get indoors, you want to put a coat. But your body temperature is regulating to be a homeotherm, right? To keep it in that window by shivering or doing whatever you do. But even insects are going to get into an environment. So it's not, they didn't totally conform. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They have a range of tolerance.
Yes. So that's exactly it. So their tolerance range, but they also, so, but the point I'm kind of making is that's a gray area, mm-hmm. right? So yes, they conform if they don't have a choice, but if they have a choice, they could regulate, mm-hmm. right? And so you think of a butterfly, you know, think of these things you've seen on National Geographic TV. The butterfly in the morning, you know, changes its wings and its position and raises them out so the sun gets up. So it's, is it regulating? It's regulating in a way, right? So it's kind of hard to put a definition that's a strict conformer or a strict regulator. And then conformers that do, you know, if you put them in that chain, in that environment, yeah, they heat them up, they're going to get hotter and they can't really do any behavioral change. And then they're going to die if they go past that critical point that they can't handle. And we can't really say there's a set window for insects as a whole, because some insects are well adapted to higher temperatures, right? And other insects are well adapted to lower temperatures. There are some really good people over in entomology here that study this midge that's from Antarctica. And it just, it can live in Antarctica in the cold. And you're just like, how on earth does it do that, you know? But even Drosophila, right? There's, I don't know, something like 300 different species of Drosophila. And we think, oh, Drosophila melanogaster, you know, the ones you use in your genetics class. But there are some that can live in a hot environment and others that can live in a colder environment. But you take the one from the hot environment, put it in the cold, it can't handle it. And then you think about just insects over the seasons, right? So if you took an insect and you put it in the freezer, let's say a beetle, and get different species, but just a beetle in general, one that's in this environment, and you put it in the freezer, you know, for maybe an hour, it's dead, right? If you took it from the summer and you just put it in there. But if you took a beetle that is out there that you could find maybe in the detritus in the winter and put it in the freezer for an hour and you took it out and it could live, you're just like, whoa, how did that happen, right? So even over the season, things can change physiologically that allow that animal to function in that cold environment, right? So a beetle, for example, if it's sensing the seasonal change, it will change its osmolarity in its body. It actually increases the proline content. It can change the salt content. What does that do? Decreases the freezing point, right? So now that animal can condition itself to handle that seasonal cold that's going to come along. It's anticipating it. But if you didn't condition that, or that animal didn't get conditioned to that over time, throughout the seasonal change, then it wouldn't be able to survive. So there, it's a little bit hard to say it just conformed versus it didn't regulate, because it might have had a physiological regulation. So the point is, the take home here is that, like everything, when you start off answering a question, what do you say? It depends, right? It depends on what we're talking about. So could we start off every answer, it depends, right? So this is probably the best thing to think about. All right, so this is where we wanted to kind of make sure you understand it's a little bit of a gray area. And some animals can handle things a lot better. And so we'll chat on that a little bit more too. So we did have that as well. Good God, where did it go? There it is. All right, let's see if this thing works. All right, so we had some of these aspects. I tried to put everything on the webpage too, but we were going to talk a little bit about, why do we study comparative physiology? And I think we talked a little bit about it. Hopefully I made an emphasis of that comparative physiology really helps us to understand lots of aspects. So this one paper that's really quite old, 1994, but it hits a lot of, I don't want you to go through every little topic on this thing, but there's some really interesting aspects. If you had ecology class or advanced ecology or evolution, it really goes through about why do people study comparative physiology, and the term might be evolutionary physiology. And so this is kind of a neat paper because it really helped people, and this relates to the next paper, why we study this or why people study this, and how does this even relate to human physiology or human medicine and health, for example. I don't know if anybody's read all of this yet, but maybe some of you, have gone through some of this. And they really wanted to kind of bring this even into med physiology classes or med anatomy courses. Has anybody read the Inner Fish book? Inner Fish? I'll send you a link to this. This guy that wrote this book, he's really good. He is a paleontologist, all right? And he's comparative paleontologist, study fossils, right, records. And what the University of Chicago Medical School, which is really good, right, they hired him to teach comparative anatomy. I mean, not really comparative anatomy, human anatomy. Why? Why do you think they had him to teach anatomy? Human dissection anatomy in the med school. And the students loved him. Because a lot of the understanding of our body comes from comparative aspects, right? And understanding how mutations occur. We can't make, all these mutations in a human and then, find out how well they function, right? But you look at disorders and then you understand, oh, they got these problems. So I mean, other animals that you can make these kind of genetic mutations, mice, other animals, and then you can see how it might affect. But to understand what that might, how that might affect that person's survival or problems. Like, have you ever seen, maybe you've seen those Indian drawings, American indigenous population, where they actually drew the shape of the hand on the rock and it has six fingers versus five fingers? And why do some people have six fingers instead of five fingers? And this genetic link. So anyways, there's a study about that, and they, knock that down to the genome to where that problem is. So I'll send you this link. It's really cool. You might just want to watch it on your own time when you're eating dinner or, breakfast or whatever to get you going. But it's so cool because he really talks a lot about these problems. And then finding that gene, that person that had it, then they looked in the gene and found out, yeah, that's that gene, and that's what coded for the sixth finger. That's pretty cool. And it was known that that happens. It's not that uncommon in the sense of they have Indian drawings on a, that's really old out in New Mexico somewhere with the six fingers, right? So that's pretty cool. So maybe that person was unique and they probably, thought it was something unusual. Anyways, a lot of our understanding, our development, our circulatory system very similar to the development in a fish, for example. Some people are born, they have it, with little slits in their neck. And people, you know, like, what on earth is that from, right? This is some kind of like weird development. Well, it's supposed to be like gill slits, right? Sometimes your aorta doesn't, how does your aorta develop? It develops and comes off the left side generally. But some people have an aorta that comes off the right side. And when you go into the hospital and you're like doing something and they find out, you know, they open you up or you have a heart attack and they put a catheter in to try to relieve the block and they're like, uh-oh, it's the wrong side. It doesn't even have an aorta on the left side. What's going on, right? How could you have an aorta off the right side? Did y'all cover this besides the ones in my 350 class? Does anybody remember? I put on my glasses so I can see expressions.
Isn't it like genes have been silenced and everything? Like evolutionary genes have been silenced for so long, but then you get a mutation that like unsilences them or like opens them up so they can be translated?
Yeah, that could, you know, and it's probably related to maybe expression level of those genes and how they go. But I'm thinking of the developmental aspect, the embryology of our circulatory system. And it might be gene related that some, you know, alternate gene is expressed or something. But our circulatory system in development as a fetus, we actually have it coming off both sides. We have 6 gill arches. And your circulatory system goes off on all sides. One of those, like the 5th gill arch, turns into your aorta on your left side. But you also have a gill arch on your right side that's 5th. So it depends. Maybe this one closed off and this one developed and you get your aorta over here. One of those, I think it's the 4th, is the ductus arteriosus. So you stay as a fetus, you bypass your lungs because your lungs didn't develop, right? So you bypass your lungs and you go from your pulmonary artery over to your aorta because you don't need to get oxygenation. You're getting it from the placenta, from the mother, and it's the ductus arteriosus. But when you're born, you take your first breath, you get oxygenation in there that turns on phospholipases, and it actually then can close the ductus arteriosus. But if you're born at high altitude, for example, this is what we talk about in our 350, like in the Andes, you don't get enough of that oxygen content and your ductus arteriosus doesn't close right away. And you could be what's called a blue baby. You've maybe heard of blue babies. There's, you know, that's the case of that. But isn't that wild? So it's really developmental. We have to understand the embryology too, but where we understanding how a fish circulatory system develops helps us explain how our circulatory and the defects that could happen that aren't our defects, I say, not in the normal population, right? So it's really interesting to study it on a comparative aspect, and this is what this paleontologist basically did, is to look at the anatomy and understand our anatomy and where it came from originally, evolutionarily. But then a lot of the pathological conditions, you can trace back to gene mutations, or if we understand the embryology, then we can understand why that disorder has come about. So it's kind of interesting in that aspect. So we'll talk a little bit about that too as we go along. When we're studying comparative aspects, you could think about, oh, that's interesting. How did that come about? Where do we have that? And where else was we going off with this thing? There was something else about the circulatory system. Yeah, so if we really understand our embryology is so cool, we don't have a good, really strong embryology course. We really go through human embryology. EKU has a really good embryology course, but you can always pick up. This is the point I want to say. You don't need a class to learn something. What do you really need? Yourself, right? And textbooks and, you know, reading on your own kind of thing. It's like Abraham Lincoln that really went to the library on his own and studied on his own and learned, you know, law and everything. People studying on their own, that having that passion, right? That passion to learn. That's the point I'm trying to make there as well. Okay, so here with this, if you look through this text, it's really quite interesting because, and there's a lot of debate about it. I think we covered a little bit about August Croak. Did we cover a little bit about August Croak? No, yes, maybe. Nobody heard of it. Okay, so that's okay. August Croak came up with this principle of, it's called the August Croak principle, and it's basically to understand a physiological process, which is really important in comparative physiology, also human physiology, is pick an animal that's really that's adapted to that extreme, say extreme environment, or maybe emphasizes a physiological concept in an extreme way, then you can study that and understand more of the subtle differences that might be shown in other animals. So a good example is the squid axon, right? The squid axon is big, and why that's so useful is because it's so big, it's like the diameter of your pinky. It's not a giant squid, it's a regular squid, but it has a giant axon. So that gets confusing sometimes. I heard a teacher say we only study giant squids for their axons. No, it's just a small squid, has a giant axon, okay? A giant axon inside there. That's a good example of the August Crook principle, because you could study how those nerves function. They originally thought that was a tendon when they dissected a squid. And what's so nice about it is you can squish out the cytoplasm, you can put different solutions in, and then you can even put a wire in there and tie it off, and now you can put that in a bath and you can understand how ions go across that membrane. And that really gave us an understanding the details of ion transport across cells and actually the shape of an action potential. How does that come about? So the squid's a good example of an August Crook principle. Another, I think we might not have talked about it, but the desert kangaroo rat is another really good example. Some of you might be allied health, you know, interested in taking MCAT. And so sometimes they ask about, like, what's the August Crook principle? They used to a long time ago, but they don't seem to have these general physiology questions anymore on their MCAT study. But the August Crook principle is another good example, is the desert kangaroo rat. You go out to Utah and Nevada, and you're gonna, when I was in a museum traveling with my kids, they were young, we were go camping for the summer, and they didn't understand why I was so excited when we got to this one museum, because they had a stuffed little desert kangaroo rat, and I was like taking pictures all over it. Because it's such a neat example of this animal has such an efficient kidney in reabsorbing water, it doesn't have to drink water. They've raised these in cages where it never drinks water. But you can give it seeds, and it can get enough water from the seed metabolism, because C6H12O6 plus six oxygens does what? Gives you six CO2s plus ATP plus, what was that word again? Metabolic water, six waters. You get water as a byproduct. And so that's called metabolic water. So this, you make water, isn't that cool? So that's called metabolic water. Well, this desert kangaroo rat not only makes that water, but it doesn't pee that much. Its kidneys are so efficient that it, you know, you want to get out by waste products, but the water is reabsorbed in the kidney the way the nephron works, and maybe we'll cover a topic of that, and it can reabsorb that water, and it doesn't pee much. Wow, fantastic. You know, it has, the anatomy's different in the kidney, actually, too, compared to us in other animals. So it can reabsorb that water. So that's another principle. If you want to understand kidney function and osmoregulation and water balance, maybe we should look at the desert kangaroo rat, how it does it in an extreme situation. It can reabsorb water so well. So that's what people did. They found this desert kangaroo rat that you don't have to put water in its cage and it can live. Just give it some, you know, seeds, and it gets about maybe 10% of the moisture out of the seed as water. But basically, because their kidneys are so well anatomy and so well adapted to reabsorbing the water that it doesn't have to drink. But take that desert kangaroo rat, put it out in the equator where there's a lot of water, it's going to survive pretty well, right? Well, with excess water. Now take a rat or rodent that has evolved out in the jungle where there's a lot of water in the South America, you know, in the rainforest, and now bring that to the desert. Bring that out to Utah, where there's little water. How well is it going to survive, do you think? It's going to die. So you get the idea that over these generations, there's been adaptation, genetic mutations that have had anatomical differences and physiological difference to allow that animal. And even if he probably raised that animal from a little animal and probably kept it water deprived through its life, it probably still would going to die by the time it's an adult if you gave it that total environment without water, right? Because it just doesn't have the ability to do it. So this is what we're talking about, adaptation. And actually studying physiological processes is really this August Crook principle. So a lot of people went this direction and to study things. But this paper does make a good point about looking at different species and physiological adaptive natures. We kind of think about, we take an anthropogenic, human-centric way that we think about it. Like, oh, it's got that, so it must be able to handle these environments, but we don't we're always putting that human concept to it, right? And it might not really hold in that sense. It might have just, hey, are all these genetic mutations beneficial? Not really, right? So we might say there's a genetic mutation that gave that. You always think like that mutation and that might have been better for them, but it might not be, right, under a different environment. So this is what we have to think about. So it's, you know, evolutionary selective pressure, right, to do things. So it's kind of an interesting aspect. So this is just really discussing a lot of this topic, evolutionary history with physiological comparative aspects, and kind of debating in the way the terms. And this is something that we generally misuse a lot too, adaptation. So adaptation, really in a biological term, we should think about that is genetic differences that have allowed this adaptation to take place over generations. But we sometimes say, oh, you adapted to the cold. You don't feel the cold so much anymore during the winter, but that's not what we mean more in a biological term, right? But we use that term sometimes. So we should say you conditioned yourself, you know, but not your genes haven't really changed. But this is still kind of mixed in the textbooks, just to kind of orientate you on that. Okay. So there's a lot of just general, really kind of interesting aspects with this paper and, you know, trade-offs that might happen. Now I had okay, and then if you've had genetics class or evolution class here, you probably went through a lot more of the terminology. I don't want you to have to bog down. There's a lot of different terminology that people use in evolutionary genetics, and we don't get bogged down in any of that. You know, kind of splitting hairs on a lot of aspects. So this gets pretty deep about all this. And then the way that people have done experiments over the years, trying to raise animals in different conditions, artificially seeing if it's going to change the genome or what happens. So, you know, the classic experiment that you understand about genetic and selective pressures, and we should understand that if you're allied health in particular, you take bacteria, right? Take it out of your GI tract if you want to, right? And you culture that in a dish, all right? So it's growing. And now you put some antibiotic on it. It's going to kill out some bacteria, right? But some of the colonies are going to survive. And now you take those colonies and you put those over in another dish. And then now you can put a higher concentration of antibiotics on, right? And then there'll be one or two colonies that survive. And then you take those colonies off and you put those on another dish. And you let that grow up. And now you can even put a higher concentration of antibiotics on there, right? And then you finally get down to this whole dish can grow at a very high level of antibiotics, right? And if you go back and take that and put it under a dish that you initially had with that low dose of antibiotics, it doesn't even touch it, right? Antibiotic-resistant bacteria, you've all heard of that, MRSA, right, for example. Wow, and you start to look at the gene differences and you might even find genetic differences in the genome, right? Because they had maybe mutations, bacteria grow really fast, and this is how we get these things that are drug-resistant. So here's an example of evolutionary change in your petri dish that you can actually study, right, and do this. I always find, anybody ever raised sea monkeys? Brine shrimp when you were kids? No? Little sea monkeys? I mean, I call old kids monkeys, but anyway, sea monkeys. You ever do them? No? You know, if you actually raise fish, sometimes you raise sea monkeys to keep them going. Aren't those amazing? Those things can dry out, make little cysts, right? And those cysts can survive without water, they're not reproducing, there's a little cyst, and they can last 100 years. So you go out to the salt lakes out in, or the Dead Sea out in the Middle East, and they've actually taken core samples down in the ground where the ocean has gone up and then down. It's like in Utah, the water that's out there, the high salt flats, they call it, there's lots of brine shrimp in there. But they've taken it down where they can go down hundreds of years where the water has gone up and down, and they have brine shrimp from 100 years ago, taken it out, and now put water around it, and you got a live brine shrimp. Wow, that's phenomenal. I haven't followed up on it, but they were doing those studies many years ago, and they were going to look at the differences in the gene, in the DNA, and see if there were mutations that were different, or now these epigenetic factors that might have been different, and compare it to the brine shrimp that are growing out today and finding out how much difference occurred over all those, you know, time periods. But it's not like it's continually getting the genetic mutation because it's already went into the cyst form. So what happened at that time, 100 or 200 years ago, compared to today? I think that's so cool. Isn't that cool? That's really cool. So this is the kind of studies that I think are just phenomenal. So you could really do a lot of different things. And back in these days when they were looking a lot about this, and you might have heard about these newer things called epigenetics, right? Where you can alter your DNA by methylation, for example, or something tags on your DNA, and that can be different. So it's not like in your, if you sequenced your DNA, you don't see the difference. But if you looked at the methylation on that DNA, then that might be different, right? So this is where they did a lot of really neat twin studies. There were some really good twin studies that were done in Spain, where they looked at these twins that were separated at birth and raised in different environments. And some, you know, were an easier environment, maybe another one that was more stressful environment. And they've seen some of the differences from the stress alone, and then others that were very similar in their epigenetic differences. So it's kind of interesting. How much did you inherit from your parents in these aspects? And now they're thinking there's quite a bit that you can get from epigenetic changes on your DNA that might be parental derived. But then the question is, did your parents have that passed on, or did you have the same environment as your parents had that you get the same kind of epigenetic, you know, like stress in your environments, things like that? So that could be it too, or maybe dietary differences or whatever toxins you might have in your environment. So this is, it's hard to address some of these aspects. You have to take them away from that environment and put them in a whole new environment. That's why some of the twin studies were really quite interesting. I can send you a YouTube link that did a fantastic overview of the twin studies on epigenetic factors. It was one of the classic studies that really led people to then follow up on a lot more of that condition and environmental changes that affect changes on epigenetics. And so this is really something that's really happening. So I don't want you to have to go through all this, but you know, you might just kind of glance through some of these things and, you know, hit the topics. A lot of work was done on Drosophila. This is what comes back to our next paper that we want to go over in a little bit. And why Drosophila? Because it grows really easy to raise in the lab. And of course, what's this building named after? Thomas M. Morgan, which is the father of genetics, right? Because he studied a lot of Drosophila. And what he studied before Drosophila was really cool too. Crab leg regeneration, right? Really, it was really neat. His first papers were on regeneration and actually in crab legs and regeneration. Then he got off onto Drosophila and genetics. But why? Because they're easy to raise in the lab and they have a short lifespan, but we'll cover some other aspects to it as well. But people then use this because they could, when they did sequence the genome of Drosophila, they had the genetic sequence, they could look at, are there mutations over periods of time when we raise them at different types of environment? And then what happens anatomically? So there's been Drosophila studies where they raised them in complete darkness for, I forget, 100 generations, and then they wondered, is there some differences in their eye development? Versus if you just raised it one generation in the dark. You know, so it's 100 generations difference in the dark all the time, right? I can't imagine some student having to change vials in the dark all the time. But anyways. And you know, their eyes' neural development is based on activity, right? So when they look at it in one generation without activity, the nervous system doesn't have the normal activity, so the connections don't develop right. When they look at from 100 generations, they found about the same thing. So it wasn't really the whole omatidia, the eye didn't quit developing or something like that. They didn't have that problem, and they're all in the same environment. It didn't give them any advantage not to have that activity from the first time they were exposed, right, the first generation. So there's a lot of interesting studies this way. And then some of them on heat stress, all these kind of aspects. And then they do find some that can handle the heat stress better. And then they started to look at, well, the ones that then bred with that heat stress, it's kind of like that bacteria experiment that we just talked about. Then they looked at that last generation that handled this heat stress over a period of time. And then you could take those versus a fresh batch, give them a heat stress, and all these survive. And you know, only a few of these would survive. So what's different? Well, they found out the ones that can handle that heat stress can upregulate what's called heat shock proteins. And these heat shock proteins can help go around other proteins. They're like chaperones, and they help other proteins maintain their structure, like ion channels functioning. So they found that, hey, well, that's pretty cool, but this that had been conditioned in the ones that survived had a better ability to upregulate heat shock proteins. But the visual aspect didn't really, you know, that didn't really make a difference. So it depends, right? That's the point. It depends what you're studying and, you know, what you're looking at. So you can't say it's always this way or it's always that way. It depends on the aspects and the conditions that you're looking at too, okay? So this is what I'm trying to get at. When you hear people say something and they're saying, oh, it's absolutely, yeah, right, okay. It depends, right? Everything depends on how you're doing it. So this is the same idea. Where else did we, there was another topic in this paper that was kind of interesting. So this was about the point about, behavioral, natural selection, and then you can think about all the different terms in here, the biochemistry, the physiology, morphology, but also put in behavioral changes too, so you might not, but of course behavior, you know, there's innate behavior and then there's learned behaviors, right? So you have to kind of think, well, where did that insect learn to go in the dirt, you know, to stay out of the cold? Is that it felt better to be in that soil than it is out in the cold, so it survived. But maybe the other ones that didn't do that are going to freeze and die. So, you know, you really wonder about a lot of these things. They're kind of interesting. But a lot comes down to what people have done over the years is to look at enzyme efficiency, and it's a bit old-fashioned. And they didn't know about epigenetic factors about those times. So I just kind of, when you look at these older papers, you kind of, and comments that they make, you have to kind of think about, there's a lot of changes over the years. Where was I going? There was something else about this I wanted to hit. Oh yeah, so this is, you know, a lot of conventional aspects were actually to look at, it's always a linear line, but we know evolutionary processes can be quite divergent, right? And it's not just so straightforward. You might get this random mutation and all of a sudden something else goes in another direction. And there's issues about, you might change one thing and how that affects in a physiological context. You might change one enzyme and you might think, oh, that makes it more efficient for this way, but it might make it less efficient for something else, right? So it's a trade-off, it's always a trade-off. It might be better for metabolism of glycogen, but it might be worse for something else, right? So we have to think about these aspects. So it depends what you're studying too, and the line that you might be studying on. So there's a lot of mixing in the field. All right, so I think that was about the main thing. There's a lot of details in there. I don't know if anybody read this, and anybody, no, yes, maybe, discussion, anything that you want to bring up? Has everybody taken, if you're a biology major, you've taken evolution class, right? Anything that you remember from those courses that you wanted to bring up in the sense of, what do they say in there that would be?
Well, it's not from evolution per se, but I am taking a class with Dr. Seifert.
And, oh, yeah, good.
It's actually over embryogenesis. Mm-hmm. So, but regardless, there was a paper we read that was exploring how we kind of came about this evolutionary process of understanding. Particularly from what I remember with this paper of like different models you can use, mm-hmm. it's a wide variety in terms mm-hmm. of evolution. Like they've been studying butterflies for a long time, but those models have not really been used anywhere else.
Yes.
So the model for evolution is way more vast, I would say, than
yes.
kind of some other processes and things like that.
Yeah.
So
good point. It's kind of like the Drosophila that we were just talking about, 300 or so different species, but which ones does everybody use for their comparative aspects or to make these relationships? It's Drosophila melanogaster. And he's like, good grief. Okay, that's not the only Drosophila that's out there, right?
And well, that gets into the next mm-hmm. paper, the mm-hmm. bottleneck paper.
The which one?
The bottleneck paper.
Oh, yeah, yeah, coming up. That's the same aspect. And then there's so many different things like this. It's just amazing. But so, yeah, I'll send you that link about it's a HHMI, Howard Hughes Medical Institution, did a really nice video of the inner fish, and we'll send you, there's a nice book about that as well. That's really cool. All right, so let's get out of that one. Then this one, I put this in here because Harold Zeikon is a really well-known neurobiologist as well, but it's a really good, aspect of just going through this to understand, and this is about the diversity, like you're mentioning, and about studying, and there again, the fruit fly. So what do people study? And this is became even more of a recent problem. NIH, National Institute of Health, said, we are only going to fund research on model organisms to understand human physiology, because National Institute of Health is health for us, right? Understand health. Where NSF, National Science Foundation, covers basic science. So, you know, study the midge in Antarctica, study crayfish or, you know, something else, right? Of course, everyone wants to study crayfish. They're great. But, so this is your funding agencies. But NIH has the biggest budget. Right now, they've been slashed pretty much, though. So what are model organisms? How do you define a model organism? And this is what they were proposed with. And they were kind of like, well, we don't really know what's a model organism. Which one do we going to call? Well, one we can play genetics with. One we understand the genome. Well, that's changed from a long time ago because we couldn't do that. Now we can. So let's change the definition here a bit. Let's say ones that we can study with genetic manipulations. Well, the regular mouse, maybe C. elegans. Drosophila, they kind of said, well, you know, that's not really a model organism. So they're actually cutting Drosophila from research. Wow. And maybe zebrafish, because it's a fish, it's a vertebrate. Maybe that's good. C. elegans, the little worm, you know. Should we keep that as a model organism? Well, I don't know. We can say genetics, but, you know, they don't really have a circulatory system like us and things like that. So maybe limited things. We'll do limited aspects. But it comes down to rodents, you know, maybe some rabbits, things like this. And you think about, well, are they really good model organisms? Did we talk about fever the other day? No? Yes? I can't remember what I'm doing. We should study about Alzheimer's and understand myself a little bit. Okay. Fever. Why do we have a fever? Anybody? We have these conceptions that we have. Some are misconceptions. You get an infection, right? And you get a fever, you get septicemia, your butt. So why do we have a fever?
I don't know if this is the misconception, but I thought it was like the body trying to kill off
the bacteria. Yeah, so that's a good point. So how do you grow bacteria if you were in a microbiology lab? What did you do with your bacteria culture dish? Generally, did you just leave it at room temperature? Did you put it in the refrigerator? Or did you put it in a
incubator?
Where are we? A nice warm body temperature, right? So if we raise our fever, what have we done to that bacteria? Maybe we're growing it better. Maybe that's worse. But then what's the idea behind that is that people are saying, well, we look at your white blood cell counts, and your white blood cell counts go up when you get a septicemic, you know, infection. But what causes white blood cell counts to go up? Metabolism going up. So is it a fight of maybe your metabolism to increase your white blood cell count faster than you can grow the bacteria? And then maybe that will help your immune system. So some people said the fever is better for your immune system. You can make white blood cells faster, and you can then fight off that bacteria. And that's kind of the rationale. Okay, let's study that in mice. People started studying this in mice. And you know there's college kids, so if you have a bacterial infection, a septicemia, for example, blood, bacteria in your blood. Septicemia could be gram-negative bacteria, it could be viruses, it could be a foreign a parasite. So that's what septicemia in general means. But most of the septicemia is a bacterial infection, usually gram-negative bacteria, and gram-negative bacteria releases an endotoxin called lipopolysaccharides, LPS. So when you release that, that triggers cytokines to be released from lots of different cells, your immune cells, even your skeletal muscle. Those cytokines can go across your blood-brain barrier. They can actually break down your blood-brain barrier in time. They go and they can then cause problems. They can go to your part in your hypothalamus where you have a set point for your body temperature, this neuron that detects your body temperature, and it can actually cause it to change its electrical firing activity to say, you have a foreign infection, we want to raise your body temperature. Is it really the cytokines itself or is it the LPS? Do you know people are still questioning that? And they don't really have an answer to that. It's something so simple, something so important for septicemia or maybe treatment, but these are still being studied to this day. Isn't that amazing that we don't have that down? But anyways, that changes your set point in your body and it causes you to then have an increased body temperature, start sweating, all this kind of stuff. okay. So even college kids have been used in these experiments, and they volunteered to do it. They, you know, it wasn't like they got forced, maybe get extra points than you did. No, they had to, you know, do the IACUC and all those approval forms and IRBs, and they actually volunteered to take injections of LPS while in the hospital, being monitored all the time. Like, how do the cytokines go up? What's your body temperature? How are you feeling? You know, all these kind of things. And so it's kind of interesting. They didn't go to the high levels to kill you, but, you know, just to find out what's going on. So now let's do these. When they were looking at mice, anybody ever work with mice? You work with mice? Anybody? Do you work with mice? And you know what happens in the vivarium? It was by accident they actually found these kind of aspects. So you take body temperatures sometimes in the vivarium. Nowadays people know about this in the vivarium care people. But let's say they were all of a sudden dying, but they don't have an infection. Their body temperatures never went up. I put the thermometers in their butt. That's how they do that. And their body temperatures were actually down. But I don't know why they're dying. This is craziness. And then they take the blood samples and they find out, well, the cytokines are crazy. They're really high. And then they look at the blood and they culture it. Wow, they got a bacterial infection. In rodents, you give them LPS, guess what happens? Their body temperature drops. Why does it drop? How does that happen? So actually in rodents, when they get an infection, their body temperature drops. And it was like crazy for animal care because they always were looking for a temperature to rise because we're what? Human-centric. We always think everything relates to us, right? And it didn't. And so now you think about, is that really a model animal to study infection? Is that, you know, related to body temperature? Maybe not. Try to give a mouse an anaphylactic reaction with peanuts. You can't do it. They don't have that. They can handle bacteria that they can eat at LPS. You can inject a mouse with LPS that would kill you, but it doesn't hurt a wild type mouse. But take a mouse that's been raised in an environment that you get from Jackson Lab and give that same LPS to it, and it'll die out. So the wild mouse can handle a high level of LPS, but a rodent that's been raised from Jackson Lab that you get is so sterile environment, you give that the same dose of LPS, it's dead in no time. So you get the idea. Depends again, and the best model, is it really good to use these Jackson Lab mice? Because they are so inbred in such a sterile environment that they're raised in, maybe those aren't good animals to study. And this goes back to this bottleneck studying things.
Can they do model organisms for specific organs or structures within the body that might be similar?
Exactly. So this is where people are pushing it. Not to get political, but there was a really good, weird thing that went on a while back. And maybe it's a generational gap. Remember when John McCain was running for president and he took a vice president, Sarah Palin? She had pretty eyeglasses, though. Everybody got her eyeglasses. You don't remember Sarah Palin? Maybe some of you do. Anyways, she was saying, we need to deal with the budget crisis that's going on with NIH. We need more directed scientific studies. I can't believe that we're funding this research in Drosophila with this guy that's somewhere in Washington State and he's collaborating with somebody over in Paris, France. Why are we funding some lab in Paris, France, working with this guy in Washington and on Drosophila? This is crazy. How are we ever gonna understand these neurological problems like autism and Parkinson's and all these other problems? Well, guess what their research was on in Drosophila? They found that in the humans with autism, a genetic mutation that relates to the protein for vesicle fusion in the nervous system to release the transmitter. They looked at that. They found it in the human that had severe autism. They have a defect in that gene that makes that protein. Guess what they were doing in Drosophila? Making that mutation so they could understand how to correct it. And that lab in France was doing all the detailed genome comparisons in the group in Washington was getting those flies to develop that gene. So exactly the thing that she was criticizing was studying that particular topic, which her nephew has autism. And you're just like, this is crazy stuff. So here's your model organism to understand those proteins that are responsible for vesicle fusion at a nerve terminal in your neuromuscular junction. Those proteins, there's many of them. There's like 200 or something of those proteins. Some of those are so highly conserved, 99.9% sequence homology from yeast, Drosophila, to humans. That protein is so highly conserved in the structure formation. So it's really quite interesting. That's how important some of those proteins really are for every little aspect. So studying that in a Drosophila, yeah, makes sense. You can get that in a days, right? You can make that mutation in no time, and then you can understand, is there a certain pharmacological agent? Would gene therapy work on it? You know, what could you do to maybe compensate for that problem? And you could do that in a matter of weeks to try to answer these questions. We're trying to look at a rodent model and do that. That's really difficult, very expensive to work with. And I don't think you want to take human babies and start injecting, you know, gene manipulations on them right away, right? So this is all the aspects. So this paper is really quite interesting to talk about the bottleneck with the aspects. And it really goes through this aspects about, here's T.H. Morgan, look at that. T.H. Morgan shows fruit flies model because they're easy to rear and maintain in short generational time. He didn't really consider all the defects that could be studied later on. They didn't really understand it at that time. He was doing it because it's a simple animal to work with, right? And it's no different than Sidney Ringer. You might have heard Ringer saline that you get your IV injection in, Ringer saline. He studied frog hearts because they were easy to work with. It's an animal that's around. You know, why not a mouse heart? They don't live well in just this. And then they found out minimal saline could keep the frog heart alive better than you could a mouse heart. And so they studied more about frog hearts and developed a saline by accident, actually, that calcium they used from a water source that was contaminated. And they found out, oh, the heart really keeps going a lot better. And a lot of these things are by serendipity. And that's why people study these animals. But it was basically because it was simple study. You can keep it alive in a lab and you can do stuff with it. It's not like it was a model animal to use for it. It was where you could actually do measurements, you know, and study these things. And then it kind of developed, the bandwagon's on it, right? This animal can survive. Like, we can study these questions, and then you keep going and keep going. And then a lot of our understanding of our heart and our pacemakers and all that activity, all from frogs, you know. It's not, you know, where we started off in mice, we probably would have never gotten where we are today, right? Just like if you tried to study the nervous system, you started that in mice, we probably wouldn't be where we are today in understanding electrical activity, right? So these are the points about using comparative aspects. We're still in this mindset of these model organisms, and even now at a funding level, this is really hurting a lot of the research. We would not have understood so many things, and using these different animals that, like even bacteria, that have such an ability to make different things like the fluorescent molecules or light-sensitive proteins. You've heard of optogenetics, maybe? Optogenetics? No. We got a new faculty member, Michael Tackenbarg, that's up here in the third floor. He does a lot of optogenetic studies. We played with it. Blue-green algae makes a protein that is light-sensitive. So the blue-green algae can go towards the light or maybe go away from the light. Depends on what that algae wants to do, right? In the sense of not what it wants to do, what it does on the protein, right, level. But then how does it detect that light? That's really wild. It can make a protein that's light sensitive, and that protein, when that light, that particular wavelength hits that protein, it opens up an ion channel in the membrane of the bacteria, and it will cause it to move, or, you know, where it can actually get out of the light, or maybe it's attracted to the light, right? And so it can change how that bacteria functions. Well, what they did was to find out the sequence of that blue-green algae that makes that protein, and now let's put that into the genome of a cell that makes dopamine in a rodent model. And so now we can make this cell that would respond, that would make dopamine normally, or maybe respond to dopamine, you know, right? Parkinson's, I'm getting on this hint about Parkinson's, right? Parkinson's, where you're shaky, it's either you're not making the dopamine, that can be one aspect, or the cells that would respond to the dopamine don't respond to it, right? Okay, so let's go to the point about, let's take it and find out that genetic code that makes those dopamine receptors. Now, let's get a virus injected into this animal in that region of that brain called the substantia nigra that infects these cells, but along with that virus, it infects them, but only where the gene is going to make the dopamine receptor does it co-express this light-sensitive protein. So now you can take a fiber optic, and they do have these models over here on campus, where they can take a fiber optic, put that into the substantia nigra region, shine a light on it, and boom, the Parkinson goes away. Because now you can activate those cells with light by using the blue-green algae that makes that protein that's now sensitive to light. In Parkinson's patients before this, they had a metal probe that they could stick into that part of the brain and then shock. And it would shock those cells. But what happens with a metal probe in your brain? Metal cuts neurons, right? And then you're going to, maybe if you got a little too high, you could burn those neurons and you could permanently damage it. So it doesn't matter that you gave a little shock, they're not going to respond because you damaged those cells. Fiber optics, you can exactly titrate it pretty well. Thin as your hair, flexible, right? You get it in there, take it out, take the needle out. Now, maybe you had to damage the neurons to get it there, but now you got a fiber optic that can move around with your brain moving and everything, and just turn the light on. They are stopping epileptic seizures. In rodent models, you can induce an epileptic seizure, know that focal point, but inject that virus that now uses a different opsin. It's one that's a chloride channel, a chloride pump called halorhodopsin, and chloride gets pumped inside the cell and inhibits the cell from being active. So what they have, these rodent models, that they can induce an epileptic seizure, so the animal's just seizing, and then boom, shine a little yellow light through that fiber optic, and the seizure's over, and the animal's just walking around, eating the food, all normal. Wow, is that not cool? But if we didn't study blue-green algae, and we didn't play with the genetics, and we didn't put those in Drosophila to begin with, we probably would have never done those rodent models. And 2 years ago, maybe three now, is the first studies that they actually did that, and they injected blue-green algae into a woman's eye where she lost the ability for rhodopsin in her eye, so she couldn't see light or dark. She wasn't responding to light. She can't see images, but now she can tell there's light in the room. That's pretty cool. Sorry, Julie.
Are these even used on humans? How does that work? Is there just always a light shining for Parkinson's patients?
No, they could turn it on, turn off, whatever they want.
Is the light built into the fiber then?
Yeah, same way. I think that's why they're doing these rodent models, and that's why we did all this research, to figure out how much can you do. And so we actually were trying to do, it's been like a couple semesters of students working, hanging out at a lab. Now, beginning, you know, everybody jumps on the bandwagon, like I'm saying, hey, this is really cool, everybody wants in the thing. Well, what about too much optogenetics? What about too much light? If you have too much, and a lot of these channels are actually calcium channels that open up. So if you get too much calcium inside a cell, you trigger what's called apoptosis, cell-regulated cell death. And so too much of it is going to kill it. You know, naturally it's going to turn on enzymes that kill that cell. So this could be a problem with using it, you know, too much as well. So it's going to be a fine titration to actually work out. You don't want too much of anything. Really. So it's pretty interesting. So this is why these models. So we've been doing this on the hearts in Drosophila, and we can actually damage the heart completely where it stops beating because it's too much calcium that came into it. So this is, you know, it's everything has limits, right? Was that a question? No, it's just one thing. So that's kind of neat. This paper is really cool about, you know, we look at these different animals we never would have known. And this is a good point, like I think you were just mentioning, Max. Use of the mouse for superoxide dismutases, SOD gene, which is common with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, lateral sclerosis, right? And they developed many of these. So, you know, 90 putative therapeutic compounds, you know, trying to develop, 11 clinical trials, all this kind of stuff, all that failed, and only one drug that, you know, came out of it, this Rizol. And we have this neurophysiology class. We actually used Rizol on different neurological preps that we have in that class, and we actually had the guy that's over in the Aging Institute and the Neurology Institute, oh my gosh, what's his name? It starts with a K, Kolotsky. He actually zoomed into our class. He works with ALS patients. That's his whole subspecialty in the neurology. He is the ALS neurologist here. And we wanted to know more about Rizol. And he said, yes, but when you get ALS and you finally get diagnosed with it, Rizol only helps about maybe prolonging life and a little bit of a quality of life for maybe 2 to 3 months, and that's about it. But you're still going to die from ALS. But Rizol is the only drug we really give. But you know, it's not really going to help that much. But maybe it gives them time to do whatever they want to do, and they feel like, you know, you want to be positive in that aspect, but you also have to be realistic about it. It's not going to help anything. It's really cool that you're studying that in your class, and that students are, you know, understanding more about it. And we put it on crab nerves. We did all these different things because of the way that they say that it helps the nervous system, they still don't know how it works mechanistically. They don't know how it works in the synaptic junctions. They don't know anything about, you know, some of the details. So how does it prolong life? What is it actually doing? Supposedly this SOD, it can decrease this a bit. So there's some aspects that, you know, lots of things that aren't completely understood. But anyways, there are like 2,000 species of rodents, you know, and how many are we actually using to study? You know, Jackson Lab has a few that you are allowed to put your NIH money for. Do you ever, so you work with rodents, and you probably have a little wheel that's in their house. Have you ever gone to the vivarium and seen them housing?
Yeah.
Okay, and they got a little wheel to keep
that. Okay,
so they don't move that much? Okay. But people like to see the activity grams of mice, circadian pattern, people do that a lot. So a lot of circadian issues, people look at circadian pattern by activity, right? So they have this little mouse on a wheel, and if you've ever raised gerbils or hurt hamsters at home, you probably have, God, I can't sleep because the thing is just going on, because they're night, you know, they're asleep during the day and wake at night, and they're going through that. So you put it in another room. My kids drove us all crazy with this stuff. We haven't found our hamster wherever it went. But anyways, people have found out they put those little wheels, and people use that for activity and looking at mutations and disease, all these kind of things with it, activity grams, all related with this, circadian patterns and genetic mutations. And then it was this group up in Indiana that studied these field mice. And, you know, they watch them, they tag them, they can actually see where they go and everything like that and how much activity they have. And then they put these little wheels out in the field, like for some food. And they found it was interesting. And they got on it, and they went on and on and on and on, and they got kind of addicted to the damn thing. Sorry, my words might be bad. They got addicted to it, and they went much more activity than they normally had. So how artificial is it that we have it in their cages for the thing? Artificial, higher activity than they normally would possess. So you see, again, we use that rodent model, but we don't understand its natural behavior and its natural environment. We induce something that's completely different for that animal. And it's bizarre. So many studies, you wonder, okay, you know, what do we do with this? Yeah. So it's really amazing. There's so many things like this that go on. So you always have to keep an open mind about things. And, you know, what's the take home here? It depends. So this was paper, I think if you look through there, I've kind of covered the main points, but there's a lot of little subtleties in this paper if you're interested, if you want to stay in research. Things like this is interesting to think about. If you're writing a grant, you have to justify the animal that you're using and all this kind of good stuff.
I've been in two mice labs, so one with like brain tumors and the one with like hard stuff. Mm-hmm. And in both of them, they never had wheels, but they mm-hmm. have like little like kind of like playgrounds or like a little like elevated thing that they could go around, and they never, but it's way less like activity than wheels. And mm-hmm. I wonder if that's why, because
probably
wheels are too much. Cool.
Maybe not to overstress them so
yeah.
much by they have no more metabolism left.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep them busy, but they can use it as a index of how active they are. Like, oh, they're awake now and they're moving, right? And so we'll use that as, but they're moving much more artificially than they would probably out in the environment. So some of those original, the studies about out in the field, wow, that was just mind-blowing. So sometimes there's, on those wheels, some people do, they actually have a plug that they can stop the wheel from moving. So they'll only allow them to move so often. So some labs are actually controlling their abilities to use those things.
Right now, for some protocols, I don't remember what the organization is. It's like monitoring animal health, making sure we're using them ethically. They'll require that they'll have like enrichment, is what they call it,
yeah.
in their cages sometimes.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting.
Yeah.
So enrichment is really important. They found out, you know, so many things like the zoo animals are really studied a lot. So if you know the guy that's down at Stanford, Spanunsky, he studies stress in animals, cortisol levels, and all that kind of stuff. Did we ever talk about that? No, we never did. So he studied a lot of zoo animals. And realized that their cages and the way that we're housing them is very stressful to them. And he's looked at cortisol levels. Even in birds, you have, you know, a parrot that's in a small cage, and they're not used to that, you know, where they're flying all over South America, Central America. And they realized, you know, they're bobbing up and heading down, and that thing's like, you think, oh, that's cute, you know, you're bobbing. But that's a stressful index. And they found out when they give them enriched environments, bigger, they don't do that. The cortisol levels drop, all these cytokines drop, and you think, oh, what are we doing to these poor animals, you know, in these cages, like, this, and that they really are stressed out, and their lifespans drop and all that. So the zoos have changed a lot about housing because of these kind of things, and because of Spelunsky, actually. I'll send you a link to it. He has some really good videos, too, but he's internationally recognized. He's one of the world's experts on stress and animal stress and mammalian stress, which relates a lot to our being, right? So pretty cool. So I didn't get through all everything that we wanted to do. But I think this is better than rushing through stuff, right? Okay, so what I really wanted to get to, too. So this is, you know, those are the two papers that you can pull down. And then I wanted to get to some of those aspects that I relate to what we're talking about, but a little bit more detail. So we have some context here. But I know that some of us haven't, maybe for, well, that's interesting. Okay. Where did my PowerPoint go to? Wow, that's interesting. Did I email you this morning?
PowerPoint? Yeah, you emailed us a copy.
Okay. So I got to find that email. Is that the deal? Oh, I know why. Because I... Well, that's really cool. I put that in a different paper. How much time do we have? We have a few minutes, don't we? Okay. So on that email, if you go through that email, and I email you through my Google account, which is probably not the best thing to do, but anyway, do it. Let's see, sent emails. Where did I do it? There it is. Because I did it on a different computer this morning. All right, so download. Cruising through this thing. So I wanted to get us all on the same page. So we talked about homeostasis, we did this, we talked about that. So quickly reviewed that we're all kind of on the same page, so if we get in a little bit more in depth, and some of this is the rehash from animal physiology, if you've had me, or if you're probably in a comparative physics course. Remember the mitochondria, right? Everybody's remember the mitochondria? I think energy, powerhouse of the cell. Do all mitochondria look like that? What do you think? Misconceptions again. Right. So we always show the mitochondria like this in textbooks, but mitochondria really aren't like that. In many cells, they're long, they're branched, they go all over the place, they move up and down the cells, but we always see these kind of things like this, so it's such a misconception. Can mitochondria bud? Can they branch out? Yeah. This is all really new stuff now that's coming out. Mitochondria can bud and make two mitochondria, right? And it's really amazing. Can mitochondria move from a cell to a cell? This is new stuff. This is just coming out recently. They're actually finding out in your skeletal muscle, mammalian skeletal muscle, you have a layer on top of your skeletal muscle inside there. It's called the plasma membrane of the cell. But above that, you've got some of this tissue in there, stuff. And then you have what's called a plasma basal lamina. And inside that basal lamina, which is like a matrix, it's not really extracellular fluid, but it is extracellular outside the muscle cell. In that basal lamina, you have satellite cells that are around that muscle. Those satellite cells, it's wild. The satellite cells can divide, and that division of the satellite cell can inject itself inside the muscle fiber, inside the cell. But what they've also found when they were looking at the satellite cells, the mitochondria in the satellite cell, guess what? It makes like a little fusion pore, and it can inject the mitochondria into the muscle cell. Wow, that is wild. And then the satellite cell, I might have gave you a misconception there. It's not the whole cell that goes in, the nucleus of the satellite cell. After it divides, the nucleus of the satellite cell can go into the muscle cell. So now you're getting a nucleus from a satellite cell that's outside that cell. In the mitochondria, that was from outside that cell, into another cell. That's wild. This is all new stuff. We have basement membrane in our heart, but we don't have these satellite cells in our heart that can do that. People were hoping, because they studied this in skeletal muscle, they were hoping you could have repair of the heart muscle cells by these satellite cells that could put their nucleus in and then help with the structure of the the muscle cell itself, but they haven't found that ability yet in cardiac tissue. But it's so cool. This is recent stuff that's come out. So they think about this also beyond that. You think about something else. You might have heard of these terms called exomes. You heard of exomes? All your cells in your body, all your cells, they didn't think it happened with nerve cells. And it wasn't until just a few years ago they found out it did. So in your muscle cells, for example, let's just look at muscle cells. Your muscle cell, you know, for contraction and all that good stuff, right? But the plasma membrane of the muscle cell can actually pinch off. And part of that tissue goes along with it. And where does it go? Into your bloodstream. What about your liver cells? They find out your livers can do that too. It's not like a synaptic transmission where calcium comes in and the vesicle fuses, and that's not the whole vesicle that goes across. Remember, that just makes a fusion pore and transmitter goes across. But this is the plasma membrane forming and making like a vesicle that then can go into your bloodstream. These are called exomes. They now realize that these are so important because this is how metastases occur in cancer. They didn't understand metastases before, how this could happen. You know, and but it was really the cancer research that went into finding out, well, you got liver cancer, how does that spread, right? How is it going to another tissue? How does it get there? Is it like all your DNA all of a sudden just screwed up? No, these exomes, and they can carry the content of the cell that they came off of. And when they go hit another cell, it's a bilipid membrane. So when you have a bilipid membrane hitting another bilipid membrane, what can it do? Incorporate.
So wouldn't it make sense that if you were to stop these exomes from spreading, that you could effectively help cure cancer?
Yeah, that's the whole thing they're trying to look at. With so now there's a group over here in Rehabilitation Sciences, Tim Butterfield, and Esther DuPont-Benchdi, she's a dean now over there, they're actually looking at exomes in the blood with exercise. And so they actually find massages on the muscle. So they take this massages, and they can actually take the blood, and they actually find increased exomes in the blood from doing that. Wild, right? Could it be used in healthy aspects for exerciser? Maybe exercising, there's things that are in there that are beneficial from one muscle fiber. So, you know, is it all neural in aspect? So when we exercise our right arm, let's just say you're lifting your right arm all the time with weights, what happens to your left arm muscle? It actually will get bigger too. People always used to say, oh, that's just because the nervous system, even though you're not lifting the weight, but the nerves are kind of firing that muscle. And if you look at EMG activity, there's actually some increased activity on it because you're lifting weights on your right arm. But also your hormones are increasing, your glucose levels are going up, and your, you know, anabolic steroids, your testosterone might be changing. So that's really the effect. But now people are beginning to question, could there be increased exomes that are being released that might be beneficial to going to other tissues in your body that increase overall? Mind-blowing. Isn't that mind-blowing? This is what's going on nowadays. I mean, it's just like, how do you keep up with this field? There's so many things to do.
Do you know if these exomes spread directly through the blood? Do they know if it does anything with the lymphatic system?
Yes, through the bloodstream and in the lymphatic. So they can isolate this from the bloodstream, and anything in the bloodstream can get into the lymphatic system, and then pretty much, you know, aspects. What was really cool, and I don't know all the details about this, but what was really cool is they thought, well, if muscle cells and other cells, liver cells, kidney cells, I mean, I don't, all these cells, all these tissues, can the neurons do this? And guess what they found? They looked at cerebral spinal fluid, and they found exomes in cerebral spinal fluid. It was like, whoa, that is so cool, you know? Yes, so, you know, what type of cell? The neurons are pretty small, so how do you get an exome out of it? Those are really small. They're about the size of synaptic vesicles. Are they really a synaptic vesicle? You know, what is it rather than doing this? So interesting aspects of all this. Who knows where it's going, right? It's just phenomenal. But then, if it goes in your cerebral spinal fluid and it goes down your spinal tract, does it get out? Can it go anywhere else? You know, those kind of things. So this is what, and it carries the content of that cell it came from, right? And so it's, if it had a defective protein or a virus in there, or, you know, something, could that be a spread? I don't know where I got off on, but anyways. So mitochondria is really cool too. People are, oh, I know where I was going. Sorry, I got completely crazy. They just found out, this guy at Harvard, Perrin's lab, he's like a god, he has an HHMI lab, you know, like 30 postdocs doing this stuff. He gets tons of money. He publishes a paper every week. I don't know how he functions. Probably has a coffee pot growing 24/7. His lab is probably like, but anyways, every time I think of a project in Drosophila, I just, you put that in PubMed, Perelman did it. Okay. Nothing left to do, might as well just retire. But anyways, so this is the kind of lab that he runs. What did he do? He looked at the muscle fibers in Drosophila, larval Drosophila, and found out if he blocked the protein called synaptotagmin 2, is that these are the proteins that are responsible for vesicle diffusion of membrane in the nerve terminal to release transmitter, but the muscle has this too. And they were wondering, why does the muscle have it? It doesn't need it, you know, it's not like for the vessels. So he blocked the protein selectively in muscles, and he found out that the nerve terminal changed its function. And then he found out what's going on is that somehow there's a retrograde message from the muscle, because muscle has to know how much nerve input's coming in, right, to make the nerve grow more or less, because like in human development, you have a small muscle, right, and the nerve has to grow to match that. So you get bigger muscle, you need more input to keep the muscle functioning. Same with Drosophila, as it grows bigger and bigger and bigger in the larvae. And so he found out if he blocked that protein that allows for fusion, that the nerve terminal doesn't grow with the muscle fiber. What is this? They're thinking that these are exomes. And it's just like, wow, he did that in Drosophila, larval muscles. I mean, wow. Okay, this other class wants me out of here. Okay, so I didn't get anywhere where I really wanted to go. So we'll finish up this, doing this basic stuff, and then have some fun with it all, okay? Sorry, I go off on tangents, but I think, isn't this more fun, kind of, than just didactic?
I learned a lot.
Yeah. Stuff. Oh, goodness grief.